This is Shabby, and coming up next on Spock's Talk is the Toig Effect.
Welcome to the Toig Effect. This is your host, Toig. Today we examine the forgotten conflict and its future. Today we look into the effects of this conflict on the country and what lies ahead. Today we review the Afghan conflict and the future of Afghanistan. On October 7, 2001, the U.S. launched its attack on the country of Afghanistan. The reason for the attack was supposedly to rid Afghanistan of the terrorist group known as Al-Qaeda, as well as the country's government led by the Taliban. But an article by the BBC on September 20th, 2001, shed some new light on the subject, entitled, U.S. Rejects Bin Laden. The story gives a different perspective on the events leading to the war on Afghanistan. According to then White House spokesperson Ari Fletcher, the real demands were quite different. In the report, he is quoted as saying, "The president has demanded that key figures of the Al-Qaeda terrorist organization, including Osama bin Laden, be turned over to responsible authorities and that the Taliban close terrorist camps in Afghanistan. And the United States stands behind those demands." In this message, there is no mention of a U.S. requirement for the removal of the Taliban-led government, only a stoppage of their supposed terrorist camps. Furthermore, the article stated the following, quote, "The U.S., which has begun a major military buildup in the Gulf, has threatened to attack if the Taliban allow bin Laden to remain in Afghanistan," end quote. Indeed, it appeared that the fate of Osama bin Laden and Afghanistan were inextricably linked. So what did the Taliban do about such dire circumstances? According to the article, the United States has dismissed as inadequate a ruling by Afghanistan's senior clerics that Osama bin Laden should be asked to leave the country. The following day, the Taliban asked to see proof that Osama was guilty of starting 9/11. But the U.S. government refused all requests. By October 7, 2001, the invasion of Afghanistan had begun, and all hopes of a peaceful settlement dashed. Why didn't the U.S. accede to the Taliban's offer for removal of Osama, and why did they refuse to produce the necessary evidence requested by the Taliban? The answer may well lie in an article by the BBC posted just 2 days before the Taliban's offer of OBL's delivery. On September 18th, 2001, a BBC article reports that Niaz Naik, a former Pakistan foreign secretary, told the BBC that he first heard of the Afghan invasion in July of that year while attending a UN-sponsored event in Berlin. According to the report, Mr. Naik was told that if the military action went ahead, it would take place before the snows started falling in Afghanistan by the middle of October at the latest. The wider objective, according to Mr. Naik, would be to topple the Taliban regime and install a transitional government of moderate Afghans in its place, possibly under the leadership of the former Afghan king Zahir Shah. He further went on to explain that handing over Osama would have been completely useless. It appears that the U.S. had already decided to attack Afghanistan and install their puppet government long before the official start of hostilities on October 7th. In this piece, I will expose the results of this illegal incursion into the nation known as Afghanistan, and I will show what lies ahead for the war-ravaged country. On February 9th, 2006, the International Herald Tribune ran an article by Obaid Younossi, a senior analyst at the RAND Corporation, a non-profit research organization. Quote, "On the eve of the Soviet invasion almost 26 years ago, I left Afghanistan as a young man in search of a better life. Recently, I returned to my native land for the first time and found that many bright and ambitious young people have been following in my footsteps, creating a brain drain that will make it much harder to rebuild Afghanistan as a democratic and economically viable nation. While in Kabul on a project for the RAND Corporation, the nonprofit research organization where I now work, I saw young men lining up in the passport office and at embassies to get documents needed to leave Afghanistan. When I asked university students whether they wanted to stay in Afghanistan or go to another country, an overwhelming majority said they want to emigrate. One of the greatest challenges in Afghanistan is to halt, or at least seriously reduce, this brain drain and attract talented Afghans to return. But how? Talented Afghans are leaving, and few are returning from abroad, because insurgent attacks, threats, and criminal activities are still common. As long as Taliban remnants and criminals continue to kill and terrorize Afghans, the nation will not be an attractive place for young people to build their futures. In addition, Kabul lacks a steady supply of electricity and clean water. The city's air is choked with dust and pollution from diesel fuel that is used to run electric generators, and from the huge number of cars crammed into a city designed to sustain only a fifth of its roughly 4 million inhabitants. Afghans with an education and skills in greatest demand know they can earn far more and live far better abroad. For example, university professors make less than $2 per hour in Afghanistan, and licensed physicians make about $100 a month working in a government hospital. To stem the brain drain and entice professional Afghans to return, the United States and the international community need to make Afghanistan a better place to live. First, security needs to be improved. This will require an intensified effort to train and supply Afghan security forces to maintain peace and order on their own, so they are not permanently dependent on U.S. and NATO forces. In addition, the United States needs to give Afghans concrete assurance that America is their long-term security partner. Second, the United States needs to work with Afghanistan to develop a long-term development plan for the nation and back it with a multi-billion-dollar financial commitment lasting at least 10 years. If it can hasten a real peace, this investment in creating a thriving Afghan economy would cost less than spending on continued warfare. Third, alternative livelihoods must be found for farmers now growing poppies, the biggest cash crop in Afghanistan and a major source of heroin sold around the world. The illegal drug trade fosters corruption and disrespect for government and the rule of law. Fourth, a system of Afghan government accountability and good governance needs to be established to ensure that U.S. aid is being spent effectively, that corruption is eliminated, and that programs are in place to improve living conditions and opportunities for the Afghan people. This means bringing readily available electricity, clean water, better roads, and new jobs to Afghanistan. Finally, neighboring countries need to be pressured to stop jockeying for more influence in Afghanistan. End quote. But a year later, things have gotten decidedly worse, not better. The forgotten conflict named Afghanistan has become a no-man's land of NATO soldiers, Taliban fighters, assorted Mujahideen rebels from various countries, and scared civilians living in constant fear of attack from warring tribes, cluster bomblets, or stray bullets. According to Reuters' report on February 4, 2007, as the snow melts in the mountainous and passes of Afghanistan, U.S.-led NATO forces are gearing up for a bloody Taliban spring offensive in what is likely to be a decisive year in the battle for this country. Last year saw the worst fighting since the Taliban were toppled in 2001 as they regrouped. With the help of safe havens and training grounds across the border in Pakistan and money from drug lords fattened by record opium crops, the first 3 to 5 months of 2007 are absolutely crucial to the entire Afghan effort as the mission has been defined, that is, in bringing security to the southern provinces. Sean Kay, a security expert and professor of international relations at the Ohio Wesleyan University in the United States, told Reuters. The rest of Afghanistan is, of course, relatively stable, but if the situation in the south isn't changed dramatically, then we may reach a tipping point where a military solution to the Taliban problem will not be achievable. it might already be too late. More than 4,000 people died in fighting last year, a quarter of them civilians. Thousands more fled their homes, and some have started going abroad again, reversing the return of the refugees. The United States, which took command of the NATO-led war against the Taliban on Sunday, has just doubled its combat troops on the ground, adding another 2,500. It's also pressing its allies for more and is asking Congress for another $10.6 billion more for the Afghan army and police. So far, only Britain and Poland have promised more troops. And the Taliban promises 2007 will be the bloodiest year for foreign troops yet, saying they have thousands of enthusiastic suicide bombers ready for action. We have made 80% preparations to fight American and foreign forces, and we are about to start war, Mullah Ayatollah Khan, a 35-year-old black-bearded guerrilla leader, told Reuters on Saturday, holding a Kalashnikov rifle and wearing a mask. Now there is a great enthusiasm for suicide attacks among the Taliban, and these attacks will increase in the future. He was surrounded by 40 to 50 fighters, some busy building anti-tank bombs, using explosives, and kitchen pressure cookers. The Taliban public relations campaign has also become bolder, mirroring their ally Al-Qaeda, with regular comments by leaders on satellite phones and slickly produced and directed VCDs of guerrillas, despite once outlawing film and music. Indeed, about the only good news for the Afghan people is that opium production is up across the country to record levels. Nearly 7,000 tons of opium was produced last year, topping 2005's record production by nearly 50%. It now appears that the Taliban will retake control of Afghanistan within a year's time, and Karzai will be forced to leave in disgrace. This dire prediction comes on the heels of events over the past 2 years that have seen all Taliban rebels released from Pakistani prisons and their armament returned to them. The northern region of Pakistan, where most of these rebels hail from, has now become a semi-autonomous region controlled by the Taliban. The Taliban have the resources, the logistics, and the fighting power to withstand any NATO onslaught. Their brand of guerrilla tactics is well suited to the terrain of Central Asia. They can play hide-and-seek at will, blending into the crowd when required, then striking suddenly at predetermined times and locations. In a June 26, 2006 editorial by Eurasianet.org, Ahmed Rashid states, Karzai has appointed 13 police officers widely known for brutality and corruption to key posts and brought back as advisor General Mohammed Fahim, a powerful former warlord and defense minister who was sacked 2 years ago after extraordinary Western pressure. The government has to base their actions on good governance and not reliance on the old commanders, said Tom Koenigs, the U.S. Secretary General, Special Representative to Afghanistan. The army and police have to be loyal, not to commanders, but to the Constitution, which is why we are against forming uncontrollable militias and parallel forces, he added. Karzai has also ignored the newly elected parliament, which is emerging as a watchdog over government excesses, and this week his office tried to clamp down on the Afghan media. Karzai has charged that the U.S. and the West have failed to provide enough resources and soldiers much earlier on when they were needed. The unhappiness between us and the international community is because we did not get the assistance and cooperation that is necessary for a strategy for counterterrorism, Karzai said at a June 22nd press conference. Karzai has also accused the West of ignoring the sanctuary provided to the Taliban by Pakistan, while officials say the militias are needed to beef up the beleaguered police force in the south. There are 40 policemen to protect 80,000 people in Uruzgan. What do you want us to do? Asked the senior Afghan intelligence official. A senior U.S. official admitted that the police training program is 3 years behind schedule, but stated that by December, Washington will provide $1.2 billion to equip 60,000 police nationwide with vehicles, radios, and weapons. Afghan officers are also furious that the U.S. will now only train and arm a 50,000-man Afghan army compared to the 70,000 soldiers first promised. Moreover, from this year, the Americans are making the cash-strapped Kabul government pay soldiers' salaries, hardly a way to win hearts and minds. Karzai is certainly right about the West's failings. With much hoopla, just 4 months ago, the government of British Prime Minister Tony Blair orchestrated the Afghanistan Compact, which promised a 5-year, $10.5 billion development program for Afghanistan, but which conveniently ignored the failures and false promises made by the West since 2001. It is clear that the slow delivery of Western aid has wrecked the political will in the government, demoralized Afghans, and given fuel to the Taliban propaganda. Thus, within a year's time, it is very likely that the Taliban will be back in charge of Afghanistan. They will be the rulers of a land even more devastated than the one they left in 2001. Most assuredly, there will be continued fighting between the various warlords across the country, and the prospects of ever-worsening conditions for the people of Afghanistan is now almost a certainty. Afghanistan will be allowed to degenerate further into the abyss of poverty and suffering. As the Taliban forces continue their steady march towards Kabul, they are returning the country to its status pre-9/11. The role of Afghanistan in the overall scheme of things is nearly complete. Afghanistan was merely, and unfortunately, a pawn in the neocons' desire to attack Iraq. Afghanistan was a necessary stepping stone that the U.S. needed to begin a war with Iraq. Through false accusations, lies, and immoral deeds, the U.S. first attacked Afghanistan, then Iraq, and through a deliberate policy of non-action and delay, the U.S. will once and for all seal the fate of that country. The Afghans will now suffer the ignorance of the world and the affliction of overzealous religious fanatics and deadly tribal warlords. The world will turn a blind eye to the travesty that it will become, and few will bother to read the daily blurbs on the back pages of Western media announcing another 10 dead in a suicide bombing in Karbala, or the horrors of children having to walk to school while crossing rivers of raw sewage. Afghanistan will become, like Vietnam, a forgotten wasteland of Western perversion, a tiny asterisk of U.S. blundering, barely noticeable outside of Kabul. The people of Afghanistan are guaranteed decades more of horrific suffering and terrifying fighting by the various factions that make up its artificial borders. The world will look on with indifference and apathy, bemoaning the result of their inaction, but not wishing to change even one iota of its outcome. For the Toig Effect, this is Toig.